Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Nice to see you all here. For those of you who are new to CSIS, I'm Teresita Schaefer, and I direct the South Asia program here. And it is my great pleasure to bring you a speaker that I think you will find most dynamic on a topic that is really important and not enough understood. We are presenting Mr. Jain in cooperation with the Asia Society, which has also given you much classier programs than we usually do. And I would like to turn the floor over to my colleague Jack Garrity, Executive Director of the Asia Society's Washington office, for whatever he wishes to say by way of introduction, and then we'll get on to what you've all come
to. Thank you, Desi. It's always a pleasure to work with CSIS, and we've done a number of projects together and programs, and we will hope to continue this in the future. As a little bit of a commercial, a week or so ago, we had Tessie and her husband, Howard, on a book talk about their two recent books. Her husband's was on the last 50, 60 years of U.S. relationships with Kashmir, which was a fascinating commentary on what's happened there in the U.S. involvement since 1947, 48. And then Tessie did a masterful piece on U.S. reinventing the relationship between U.S. and India. And she talks about a number of areas of interest and congruence, and a number of issues that may be challenges. And I recommend both of these books to you. She is definitely an expert on South Asia and on India, and has talked all around town and is recognized as one of Washington's experts in the field. But today we'd also like to welcome our main speaker, Mr. Raj Jain, who's the CEO of Walmart in India and the managing director and CEO of Walmart Bharti, which is the joint venture Walmart has in India. He's a man with a lot of experience in the retail sector, having worked run emerging markets for Walmart out of Shanghai. So he's been working in China. And before that, he was with Whirlpool for 10 years in India. So he certainly knows his way around the retail field. And previously, he was educated in India, studied engineering, and then got an MBA at the Kellogg School. What he's going to talk about today is basically Walmart's supply chain activities and how they affect rural India and farms and food supply. And it's going to be interesting because a lot of people don't realize Walmart's role in this area. We're all usually, you know, think of Walmart as a big retailer here in the States, but Raj will tell us a little bit about what goes behind it. So without further ado, I'd like to invite Raj to give a presentation.
Good afternoon, everybody. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah.
And thank you, Jack, for that introduction, and thank you, Ambassador Schaefer, for this opportunity. Thank you to CSI and Asia Society.
I think you just need to be a little bit closer to the mic.
Okay. And thank you to CSIS and Asia Society to give me this opportunity to be able to share some of our experiences in India with this August gathering. So I'll go straight into my presentation. I'll try and keep it brief. Idea would be to just use this as thought starters for some good Q&A session after this. I've been associated with the Walmart India initiative for over 3 years. I have to say Walmart's interest in India, of course, has been even before that. But we've been sort of looking at several emerging markets in the last 5-7 years outside of U.S. to grow in. And I've been lucky enough to be with the India project, even when I was in Shanghai. So I can talk a little bit about, you know, how we thought about it, what we've learned from it, and what are some of the challenges as we go forward. Just for those who are do not have a history about Walmart's India initiative as well as India's retail landscape, India has very restrictive laws on retailing, even till today. Foreign companies are by and large not permitted to operate in the retail space in India. The only space where foreign companies can operate is the wholesale, or what is Indian government calls cash and carry space, and that is open to foreign investment. Also, if it's a single brand retail, then 51% is open to foreign investment. So it does serve the interests of some retailers like IKEA, who are mass retailers, not in food and grocery though, or very niche players like Louis Vuitton and some of those kind of brands. But largely it is a restricted sector, if you like, to foreign investment. With that constraint, we tied up with the Bharti Group in India 2 years ago, just over 2 years ago. And we have really two business models going there. We have a 50-50 joint venture with Bharti for our wholesale cash and carry operations. And with that, we've just set up our first store in a place called Amritsar in north of India about 6 months ago, and I'll share some of those experiences with you. The restriction there is that we are only allowed to sell to business. We cannot sell to end consumers. So we have a membership program, much like the Sam's Club in the U.S. But, whereas in Sam's Club in the U.S., you can make any kind of, member. In India, it has to be a bona fide business who can be members and then shop at us. And then the second part of our relationship with Bharti is more like a franchisor and a technical services provider to Bharti Retail. Bharti has a retail company which they've started about 2.5 years ago. We provide Bharti technology, management services, information technology, and also goods from our wholesale company. But essentially, they run and own the retail operation. But through that relationship, we as Walmart do have a good insight into the Indian consumer and the habits and the shopping habits and the changing landscape of retail in India. So with that, let me just straight jump into my presentation. I'll take a little bit of time to just set up India for those who are, don't know India in detail or would like to know a little bit, or at least from our perspective, how it impacts retailing. And largely, India is a growing economy, but a very young country in terms of population and so on. And it is also highly price-sensitive customer. And I'll explain a little bit about why the customer in India is price-sensitive. This just shows, data about India versus U.S. and European Union. And most of you have probably seen this kind of data before, so I'm not going to go into the detail. I think what jumps out at this is, number one, the population. India is about 1.2 billion people, unlike the U.S., which is 0.38, and EU is 0.58. GDP of India is about $1.1 trillion now. So it's getting there, but it's still significantly behind the U.S. and Europe. But most importantly, if you tumble that all down into GDP per capita, it's still very, very low compared to some of the developed economies. And when business talks about India, we need to understand that that indicator is very critical, because our customers don't buy as all of India. They buy as individuals. And at an individual level, the consumption and the GDP per capita is still very, very small. So what that relates to a consumer behavior, which is very different from what you see here in the U.S. Or in Europe. Having said that, the economy is growing very fast. It's the second largest growing, fastest growing economy in the world, at somewhere around 7 to 8%, depending on when you take the cut. It is also a hugely urbanizing country. And this whole urban migration is happening very rapidly, second again only to China. What this data shows is that by 2050, half of India would be urbanized, which is, you know, is putting enormous strain on urban infrastructure in India, which is also kind of goes to why for retailers like us, real estate in a city like Delhi is almost as expensive as real estate in some parts of New York. So one would wonder, you know, in an emerging economy like India, why is real estate so expensive? And the reason is because there's so many people moving every year from the villages to the cities, it's driving up the price of real estate, especially in cities where infrastructure is relatively speaking better than in other cities or in urban India or in rural India. Here's a little bit of demographics about the population and the age of that population in India. And as you can see from the chart on the left here, 80% of India is below the age of 45, and half of India is below the age of 25. So it is a very, very young country. And that drives, a consumer behavior which is very different. Good thing is young people are consumption-orientated. They want change. They are open to shopping in newer and better environments. The problem is, though, is they don't have enough money to spend. So what they spend, they want to stretch their rupee as much as they can, and they demand a significant value for the money they spend. So that's some of the behavior we see in our customers, too. And that leads to, these two pictures I just wanted to show. The lady on the left here, this is a typical middle class or should I say lower middle class household in India. This lady is a homemaker. She would probably buy all her commodities, her food, her agriculture produce, all her staples, etc. Pretty much if you can see at the shelves at the back, it's something she buys at the time of harvest. So every time there's a harvest, she would go out and take advantage of the low prices at the time of harvest, buy and store for 6 months or a year. And that's her pattern of buying, which has its own challenges. So, that's how she would add value, if you like, to the household in terms of the low household income and how she can stretch the rupee for her household. And on the right, just modes of transport, various modes of transport, two-wheelers, cycle rickshaws, walking, and so on and so forth, because those are easy and cheap. And consumers in India would not travel long distances to go and do grocery shopping. So when actually Walmart announced their joint venture in India, the often asked question was, are you going to open 200,000 square feet boxes like the U.S.? And the answer was clearly no, because nobody in India is going to travel 10 kilometers down the road to buy grocery and food, from the kind of large boxes you see here in the U.S. Here's just some examples of what that has driven from the point of view of products and services. I'll talk about some fast-moving consumer goods, sachets. I mean, these are single-dose usage items. They started in the 90s with shampoos and driven by some companies who wanted to promote, use of shampoos with India, with Indians. Shampoo was a relatively expensive item at that point in time. These are typically priced at 2 to 10 cents. You use them one time and you throw away the packaging. But since 35-40% of total shampoo consumption is out of sachets in India. But what this has done is this has also, led to a packaging revolution in India where hair oils, cooking oils, detergents, spices, all kinds of things are being sold in sachets because the unit price is low and low-income families can buy them, use them one time, and then wait for them to earn enough to be able to buy them the next time. Cellular phones. India is probably the cheapest cellular phone market in India. It's also the second largest market now in the world and amongst the fastest growing. But per minute call rates is 1 cent, less than 1 cent a minute now, actually. I have kids studying here in the U.S. It's cheaper for me to call them than it's for them to call me. And that used to be completely different 5 years ago. And that's how it's changed. And it's cheaper for me to call them from my mobile phone than it is to call from my landline. So that's how I'm just trying to remember how much I pay, about 5 rupees a minute to a call to U.S., which translates to 10 seconds a minute. So not that I talk to them for an hour, but, I mean, it's not an awful lot of money to make a one-hour call from India on a mobile phone. So that's how this is being driven. And lastly, some of you may have heard of this Nano launch. It's been internationally well covered. It's a $2,200 car right here on the on the right is the picture. The car is already on the roads in India. It's just been recently launched. Again, you know, it's early days, but if it's successful, it's an outstanding value for an Indian consumer. Maybe have application in a lot of other emerging markets in terms of how families can move in and around in cities. So really, from a retailing perspective, the point I'm trying to make is that when we looked at our industry, we clearly are looking at a consumer who wants to change their shopping habits, who wants to buy things at one place, but also wants to buy them cheap and also wants to buy them in quantities which are small. The problem, though, is that the current retail environment in India is very fragmented and it is very inefficient at the back end. And normally, from a consumer standpoint, you know, people look at retailers and look at all the stores, but the stores are only as good as the supply chain which supplies them. And to make the whole economic model work, you need a very robust, supply chain at the back end to be able to feed those stores in an economic way. And that really is the challenge of retail in India. And the truth is, as India grows, the current retail environment is not efficient enough and good enough to meet the aspirations and the economic reality of India going forward, because it is highly inefficient. The size of the industry is about $360 billion, so it's a huge industry from the point of view of retail. In fact, 60% of India's GDP is personal consumption, which is very high compared to any other emerging market. But the organized retail is only 5% of industry. And if you go to food and grocery, it is actually less than 1% of industry. The 5% comprises largely of, is driven up largely because of apparel and automobiles and some of those things which drive it up. But otherwise, it's for food and grocery, it is less than 1% organized. So it's pretty much a largely unorganized industry. And here is, what it takes to take products to consumers. You know, there are suppliers like farmers and suppliers who, distribute products, and finally that reaches the customer. The four issues I wanted to highlight here is which we believe, and in our experience in India, are truly areas of concern. Is first of all, there is a lot of wastage, and the figures are staggering, and they vary. But even by the most conservative estimates, anywhere between 5 to 7% of all food grain gets wasted or rots. Anywhere between 20 to 40% of fruits and vegetables and produce gets wasted or rots. So there's a huge amount of wastage in the supply chain in India today. The system doesn't work together. Everybody's working in their own silos. So therefore, nobody has an understanding of what the end consumer needs and how that impacts their product or their business. And as a result, there is a huge system inefficiency, because most of the trade wouldn't really know what the consumer wants truly. And that causes a lot of imbalance. Thirdly, the current intermediaries, the way they work, anywhere from 2 to 6 intermediaries before product reaches reaches the end consumer. These intermediaries, unlike in countries like Japan, where there are several intermediaries too, and who are very expensive because they arbitrage, or the amount of commissions they keep are in double digits. Intermediaries in India normally work on 1 or 2% commissions, so it's not an expensive intermediary, but it does make it very, very cost inefficient, because each intermediary would keep an inventory of their own. So the inventory is then sitting in 5 or 6 places before the product reaches from supplier to the customer. So in a total system sense, there's an enormous amount of inefficiency. And finally, poor infrastructure. India is coping with high urbanization, rapid growing demand for power, roads, water, etc. But the infrastructure investment is not keeping pace with that demand. As a result, infrastructure is poor, and that leads to cost inefficiencies in the whole distribution chain as well. And I'll talk a little bit about that. So these are the four areas which are core to India's current distribution problems. Here are some pictures which just shows food chain. You know, all the produce in India is sold through 7,000 plus what locally in India is called mandis, but it's actually a wholesale market. There's a picture for you right there. And, you know, a lot of wastage takes place, a lot of rotting takes place, a lot of, inefficiencies built into this kind of a model and system. The food wastage number is staggering, as I said earlier. It's almost $20 billion of loss as a result of food wastage. And increasingly, this is a big issue. And the reason I want to point this out is that as you talk to people about food security across the world and about, how can we feed the human population across the world over the next several years, there's a lot of talk, at least in countries like India, about farm yield and productivity and farm technology. Our experience and plea is that there's a big amount sitting outside the farm. And really, the medium-term answer in terms of better and food and inflation control lies outside the farm, not in the research in the farm. Because a lot of wastage is taking place in the food supply chain today outside the farm. Suppliers of non-farm produce, just gives you an example here of, how the vendor packs are. And just an example of a simple item like pencil boxes. We ran a back-to-school program in some of our stores recently. In each store, we sold 33 pencil boxes in a month's time. The vendor pack for this is 288. So it's basically a year's supply to each store. So if you don't break bulk of this vendor pack in your distribution center, then you're pretty much shipping to a store a year's supply of pencil boxes. And then there are these two colors, and nobody really knows what the consumer choice on colors is. So each box you open would have a random assortment of colors too. So you may run out of the pink pencil boxes and still have lots of green ones left. So those are the kind of issues which a traditional retail supply chain is currently facing in India. And working with vendors to reduce the size of this out of packaging is a key initiative which we are undertaking. Fill rates are very poor. Vendors are not, because there are so many intermediaries currently and there's so many places where inventory is stocked, vendors are not focused on fill rates. And the best fill rates you get in India are of about 70%. So any orders you place on vendors, there's only a 70% chance that it'll get fulfilled within 24 hours. So you have to have a supply chain which is intrinsically, geared up for that kind of fill rates. And then compliance, ethical compliance, say food safety compliance, et cetera, is very poor because there's just no transparency, there's no focus, and there's no visibility to this to either the customers or in some case even the suppliers. Here is a traditional distribution, how it exists in India. It's a two-step process. There are distributors and there are retailers. And these distributors could be two-stage distribution, which is wholesalers and semi-wholesalers, or sometimes even three-stage distribution in rural India. Overall, India has as much as 5 to 7 million outlets. So it has a huge number of outlets from a retail perspective. And all of them are fed through this wholesale and semi-wholesalers. And the best of the companies in India, like Unilever and there's a local company called ITC, reach less than 1 million. So the balance, which is almost 80% or so, is fed through this wholesale and retail channel. And, there is a limited amount of stock in these wholesale channel, and a typical retailer will have to visit 5 or 6 wholesalers to be able to fill their full basket of what they need before they go out and go back to their own stores to sell stuff. On the retail side, a typical retail store is on the right-hand side. They'll probably be about 500 square feet or less, so you know, almost one-third the size of this room would be a typical retailer. They'll probably store less than 1,000 SKUs, which, just to give you an idea, a standard middle-class consumer would need anywhere between 3,000 to 4,000 SKUs to complete their basket over a month. So they can only keep 1,000. So you know, a consumer may have to shop at multiple locations and multiple retailers to be able to meet their entire month's buying needs. And although it's low cost, these are called Kirana stores. Although they are very low cost, I mean, they are intrinsically very inefficient. The shopping ambience is, as you can see, is fairly poor, and the range and quality is not always the right. And on the left is a typical wet market where produce is sold. And I don't have a picture here. I have it later. So produce can be sold either through a wet market like this or a pushcart vendor who would show up at your residence to sell. And lastly, about infrastructure. I talked about, the lack of infrastructure. Here's the road infrastructure. So, typically in India, you would cover one-third the number of miles in an hour as you would in a developed country. So distance is no longer measured in kilometers or miles. It's measured in time. And that's why people will not travel outside their homes, because 10 or 15 minutes in the U.S. can get you maybe a few miles. In India, it'll probably get you 1 kilometer away from your home. So you might as well just walk it. And that's what people would do. So, secondly, power. And once again, there's a lot of talk about investment in power and private investment in power in India, because India is short of power. In our belief, it's at the wrong end, because power plants, yes, we need a lot of more power plants, but we need first a distribution change before we need more power plants. Because as you can see from this photograph, the inefficiency of distribution and the downtime because of poor distribution is huge. So even if there is power, there is no easy way to distribute it to people's homes or factories or whatever. And secondly, there's a complicated state electricity board mechanism which doesn't allow the power companies to charge the right tariff from the consumers. So therefore, it just becomes unviable for people to invest in power plants. So the real issue is, again, distribution. It is not generation power. Just like, as I said, in the case of agriculture, it's not about production. It's about distribution of agriculture produce. So our mission globally as Walmart is to save people money so that they can live better. And that is sits very well with an emerging country like India, where people, younger consumers, are looking for quality products, good ambience to shop in, but at low prices. And this is how we are trying to do it, moving from what is available selling to what the customers really want. And we broke this down into being efficient, being inclusive, and being sustainable in the way we serve our customers. Quickly about our joint venture, I just mentioned we have a joint venture with the largest telecom company in India called Bharti. And they own the front-end stores and the retail stores, because that's not permitted for foreign retailers to open. So they run three formats, small, medium, and large format stores, and they own the real estate and so on. And we own the back end, plus we run a format called the cash and carry format, which are business-to-business operation only. Here are some of the pictures of our stores. Bharti has 30 stores. And we, on the cash and carry side, we've opened one, and we'll be opening six more in the next 12 months. These are on the left, top left-hand corner is they're branded Easy Day. The retail stores is like a 3,500 to 4,000 square feet neighborhood store. It keeps about 4,000 SKUs, and that's the inside picture of one of those. And then there is a compact hyper, which is more like a 40 to 50,000 square feet market in a mall situation, and that shows one of the pictures inside that. And then this is the outside picture of the business-to-business cash and carry. This is a brand named Best Price. The only thing is that we can only sell to business members, cannot sell to end consumers. But even then, the response to this this format has been outstanding in the first 6 months of our business. Just to explain what we are doing or some of the areas we are working on, first of all, nothing is going to happen overnight. So this is a long process which will take several years to get done. But I think we are learning every day, and we are making a little change every day. We have, what we would call about four types of suppliers. Private brand suppliers, where we who do our private brands in food products, staples, you know, pulses, and those kind of commodity items. There, the whole idea is to just train them on global food safety standards, packaging, etc., improving quality. And again, learning from our customer feedback and improving the whole supply chain as we go along. And then there are regional and national Indian suppliers who we are able to or will be able to give national access. And because of the wholesale system today, many regional suppliers are not able to supply their products to other regions in the country. So with modern retailing, they should be able to do that. And we are working with them closely to improve, again, their food safety standards and food traceability issues and so on. And secondly, with small suppliers to give them wider access to markets. Then there are these government cooperatives, largely tend to be in the dairy area because it's a protected area for the government. And we are working with them in terms of vendor pack size, either reduction or increase in some cases by providing customer feedback. And finally, of course, we have a lot of global suppliers too, like the Procter & Gamble's and the Unilevers and the Colgate's. With them, it's a much easier ride because it's a question of just building in the efficiency, improving fill rates, bringing more transparency, hooking up their ID systems to ours, and just making them more aware of the relationship because they are used to working with companies like Walmart and they understand what it takes to run a supply chain. So this is much easier than the other three supply types. Here's something we've started doing in the last 1 year, working directly with farmers. And it's been interesting because we thought that if we source directly from farmers, that will solve most of the problems. But that hasn't been the case. Having said that, it has taught us a lot of good lessons. And really, we work with 65 farmers in a village in Punjab, where most of our stores are, sourcing directly from them. Today, we source almost 30 to 35% of all our produce directly from the farmers. But we've also learned a lot about, the issues of the farmers. And the issues of the farmers are essentially, again, relating to not the technology on in the farm. And we did work with them on that, but essentially to what happens after the farm. Because currently what they do is they all, in a community of farmers who do, let's say, fruits and vegetables, everybody will harvest their tomato crop on the same day, almost, within plus minus 2 days. So when they take that perishable tomato to the nearest wholesale market or the mandi, what happens? The price of tomatoes just crashes. And what they get is really one-third of what they would have otherwise got. And now that they have harvested the crop, they have no other option but to sell it at whatever price they're getting and collect the cash and come back home. And if they had some visibility to the consumption pattern of tomatoes in that vicinity where their produce is going, they could have, sort of phased out how they harvest their tomato, they sow, and they harvest their tomato. So that would save so much in terms of food wastage, get them better price realization, and get a fresher and better produce to the customers. So it's just the transparency of the entire supply chain which can make the big difference here to the farmer and to the consumer, and then working on the new seed variety of tomatoes with these farmers. So that's been our biggest learning here in this whole exercise. Also, the smaller retailers who buy from wholesale market through our cash and carry, we service those wholesalers. And what we are finding is what they really like about us is not our prices, but consistent availability. and they have suffered significantly in their businesses because in the wholesale market they are not able to consistently get what they need for their customers. And that has been, you know, really our biggest learning, because we thought, you know, prices is going to be what really will be competitive for us and would be our competitive advantage. But really, availability more than pricing is at this point in time our competitive advantage. Not to say that pricing is not important, but, you know, just sheer availability itself is a huge wow for our customers. The other experiment on the farm side we are doing, on the right-hand side bottom, you see a photograph. This is a push cart. Typically how fruits and vegetables would get sold in neighborhoods in India. We recently donated push carts to 10 unemployed youth near our store. And they buy produce from us every day, and they take and sell it to their customers every day, and then they come back. And so the whole chain, if it works, I mean, it's still early days, but promising is we buy from the local farmers, and we break bulk at our store, and then we sell to the pushcart vendor, and the pushcart vendor goes and sells to the end consumer. And that way you can create enormous transparency of consumption and what you sow, when you harvest, and how you sell. And in the process, you know, employ these unemployed youth who would otherwise be looking for either on-farm jobs or have no jobs otherwise. On the talking about employment, and there is, I mean, as I said earlier, there are a lot of young people in India. You know, almost 50% of the country is below the age of 25. And when it comes to education, there's a lot of talk in India, and when it comes to U.S. and India, about higher, you know, centers of learning. So there's a lot of discussion around, you know, how do we get access to U.S. Higher education learning institutes to a market like India. The truth is that in countries like India, that's very, very small portion of what really India needs. And I would even argue that, you know, that's not even relevant to what the issues are. The issue is really at the 18, 20, 25-year-old kid who really needs the first job. And they can't find that job on the farm because the farms are, you know, there's just too many people on the farm, and the farm size is so small that in a family of four or five, there isn't enough work for those many people. So they're looking for jobs outside the farm. They don't have enough to be able to go to a university or college education. In any case, the education infrastructure is poor, so they need vocational training so they get their first job. And with that in mind, we tied up with the Punjab government in India, where our store is, and set up this training institute where we give a 3+1 4-week training to these young kids. And they just get ready to do their first job, just basically understand what's a supply chain, how to stock shelves, and simple things like that. And we've already trained, now this is an old figure, about 1,500 young students from there. 400 of which have already been employed, 100 we've employed ourselves. So it's a system which creates employment at the first rung of the ladder outside the farm, and then they pretty much move on with it as they self-educate themselves. And finally, about sustainability, I think, as I said, the Indian consumer is very price sensitive, and that means you have to spend your capital very wisely, and you have to use your space very wisely. Space is expensive in India for all the reasons I talked about. So space and capital productivity is critical in terms of how you set up a supply chain and how you set up stores. So, for instance, our urban stores in metro towns like Delhi, we don't have any back rooms. You know, we've chosen not to have any back rooms. The back rooms are just the risers, you know, above 7 feet on the tall steel we put inside the store. And we have to supply those stores maybe twice a day so that we can replenish them, especially on weekends when the traffic is high, twice a day to not run out of stock because there is no back room. So those are some innovative solutions for countries like India which we need to figure out because those kind of things are not challenges in many developed countries. Also in terms of energy efficiency and so on, you know, working just to ensure, as I said, infrastructure is poor, so you have to invariably have backup generators in every store you have. Cost of, you know, generating power in those small, inefficient generators is almost twice of what you would get from the grid. So just once again, you know, how much lighting you use, what kind of lighting you use, what kind of air conditioning you use, all those things have to go through a microscope just to ensure that, the whole energy consumption is well within control. So overall, I think, that's how we are making the change to this whole supply chain. There's almost the estimate is India needs about $20 billion of investment in just this kind of retail infrastructure at the back end to be able to make this possible going forward. And one of the areas we were working with the government on is, how does the government open foreign direct investment to retailing so that infrastructure can be built? Because government's view is, foreign retailers should build the infrastructure and not worry so much about the retailing. And the truth is that if you don't have control over the front end of what the consumer wants, then the whole loop doesn't get completed. So that's why this issue is so important. And then, of course, sharing technology and management through this entire supply chain. So really, I think those are some of the sharing of our 18 months of experience in the supply chain side, both at the farmer end and the suppliers and what happens in the store. And with that, I open this up to questions.
I wonder if I could exercise the prerogative of being up here, if not the chair, and ask our speaker one question. I was struck by your observation that in looking at your wholesale market, you had been surprised by the feature that most attracted your retail customers, namely consistent availability. I wonder if you had any similar, you and Bharati together, had any similar surprises when it came to the retail market and the retail customers. You mentioned, for example, that the small kiranas provided personalized service, and certainly when I've lived in India, it's been my observation that people know their vegetable vendor and they know the guy who provides batteries for the clock, and at this point, I know the cell phone vendor because I go in there every year to get a new SIM card. Is this a factor that's given you any surprises in figuring out how to structure your approach to retail sales?
Yeah, I think, a couple of surprises. I mean, the fact that the Indian consumer is very price sensitive, I think we pretty much knew, and that is how it's turned out. So I think that has not been a surprise. I think one of the biggest surprises has been this whole concept of home delivery. In urban India, there's a lot of talk about people don't want to go shopping and they want home delivery and the local kirana grocer will home deliver it to you. And that is true. So invariably, you could just make a phone call. And as I said, phone calls are almost free these days. So you can make that phone call and just, say, I want this, this, and this, and give a list, and in a few hours all that stuff will arrive at your doorsteps and you pay and the deal is done. And we started home service as well, just because we wanted to be competitive, or Bharati wanted to be competitive with the local kiranas. What our experience has been is that people don't want home service from us. They want to actually come and shop at our store. And the reason is because they love doing it. So just, as they get the choice, just they enjoy shopping and the fact that they can spend, in a small 5,000 square feet store, half an hour or whatever, they love doing that. And they love doing it twice a day. So this whole thing about home service or home delivery has been a bit of a myth, which, was a big surprise to us. So that's just one. Yes, please.
I could ask you to identify yourself and your affiliation.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm Paula Stern. I have my own consulting firm, the Stern Group. And for purposes of today, I'm a former director of Walmart. And it cycled off before you have put your whole mind and effort to this India venture, which is just fascinating, and thank you for a wonderful presentation. I felt like I was back in the boardroom. And I think from a point of view of development, talking about this is much more practical and productive than a lot of development discussions I've gone to when it comes to India. So thank you. My question, I guess, is about your plans, particularly the restriction on the FDI. That is clearly an area which I'm sure is sensitive for you to answer, but which I really would appreciate your assessment of how willing India's regulations or how flexible they would be going forward. And I guess I would ask you related regulatory issues about, I think you've had a figure up there of the number of regulated markets, the mandis, whether they grow every year, and whether that is another a regulatory change you would like to see. And then finally, I wanted to ask about the distribution center. You had, it was singular. You're talking about opening six more, at least what would be the equivalent of the Sam's Clubs?
Yes.
Or, yeah. I'm interested in the relative density of those distribution centers in your plans going forward compared to the way Walmart operates in other venues, particularly developing countries. I understand that U.S. and North America is not equivalent, but other developing countries.
Okay, thank you. Let me start with the plans and the distribution centers first. I mean, we have six more cash and carry stores planned over the next 12 months. The cash and carry stores, actually, we do not supply through the distribution centers. We get directly into the store. It's a large store. It's 50,000 square feet from an Indian standards, that is. And therefore, we can, and because it's a bigger box and it has a bigger sales velocity, we can get truckloads of goods straight in. It's also cost efficient because you don't need to, you know, load, unload, and break bulk and so on and so forth. So in many ways, these are just standalone boxes with no distribution centers behind it. We currently have one distribution center in Chandigarh, just outside Chandigarh in Punjab. We're setting up another one just outside Delhi as we expand and get ready to supply to Bharti stores, which are growing as well, coming down from Punjab. As far as the APMC mandis are concerned, the 7,000 of those, yes, they are growing. Every day, certainly every month, there'll be a few more added. The federal government is actually very keen on repealing this act because this was set up as a protection for farmers 30, 40 years ago to give them a market where they would not be disadvantaged by traders. But all that has changed, and what has happened is that the mandis themselves have become an area where there are broker networks operating with much better control and, in some cases, almost a cozy alliance where, the farmers still don't get what they needed to get. So the answer to that, the government's answer to that is a minimum support price for food grains, which is a government-mandated price. But that can only be done for a few things, like wheat and rice. But when it comes to produce and pulses and staples and many other items, there isn't a regulated price. So I think the federal government is keen to unpeel that, but the states have been resisting for various political and other interests. As far as the your first question on FDI in retailing is concerned, certainly our belief is that the government should seriously look at that as the next step. Government's view so far has been that, look, first we need to develop the infrastructure, the supply chain, etc., and then worry about FDI and retailing, because there is a likelihood that, investment by foreign retailers, etc., may lead to closing down or marginalizing of mom-and-pop stores across the country. I think those fears are largely unfounded. If you look at China or look at any other emerging country where foreign direct investment is open in retailing, Even in China, after 15 years, 80% of the market is informal market through mom and pop. But to expect large retailers to develop complicated supply chains and invest $20 billion to put that up without having to be able to serve their customers on the front end and generate economic value from that, I think it's an unreasonable expectation. So that's a dialogue, ongoing dialogue. Let's see what happens in the next few years.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yes, please. I think it's at, I'd answer the question at two levels. I think at an intellectual personal level, most people will get it and understand and agree. At a government political level, there are, I think, other issues which are way beyond retailing and so on, which influence what they would actually say. So in private conversations, it is not a long discussion. In public conversations, it's a slightly different issue altogether. Having said that, I think there are people who genuinely are concerned about this, and I think the onus is on people like us to demonstrate. And we've just started the journey, so it's not like we've done our job and we now need to expect the government to do theirs. So I think we need to demonstrate that this is indeed a model which can work, and make the farmer. And the consumer and the trade all happy with this whole investment in the supply chain. So I do believe that over the next 12 months, as we open 6 more of these and demonstrate that locally, I think the there will be a bigger swell of people who get convinced. Yes, please.
Hi, Vijay Rajendran from AC County. My question is about some of the consumer trends that you described. Do you think that the sachet phenomenon in consumer goods is going to continue, or do you think it's peaked now that mini hypermarkets are more popular and incomes are rising? Or could it, what's been seen in the cities in the last 10, 15 years, could be replicated in rural areas?
I think the low unit price, the one-time dosage, and will continue for a very long time. And the reason I believe that is for several reasons. First of all, the per capita income level is still very low. And a lot of people are on daily wages. So they are literally earning for the day and then spending for the day. And what they can afford is for that day. So essentially, I think that drives a lot of sachet-type consumption. I think in the urban markets and the more affluent parts of the country, the problem is people live in very small homes, and therefore they do not have the physical space available to buy goods beyond, let's say, a week or 2 weeks or 4 weeks or whatever it is, and therefore they want pack sizes which are small. I think thirdly, there is a lot of emphasis in India in terms of food and other consumption about freshness. So whether it's dairy or produce or meat or whatever consumption, it's all about you buy for the day and you use it and it's fresh and it's healthy, and then let's worry about the next day. And I think that drives smaller units. So my own view is I think this is going to be here for a long, long time. Yes, please.
I'm Chidan Adharajagar from Times of India. I just happened to be traveling last month, and there was a number of opportunity to visit the store. Actually, it struck me how close Amritsar is to the border. I thought if you had put the store on the border, you would have served 2 markets.
Yeah.
Hey,
maybe one day we'll do it, yeah.
But I'm wondering if it's going to start happening. And,
Yeah. And I think that's a good comment, because I think in the end, I think that's something which the government needs to realize as well, that, you know, if you put artificial barriers too long, then they just don't work. People always find a way to work around those. But having said that, I think all I can say is that how our stores and our experience and what we are trying to do is different from what you probably saw at Metro in Bangalore. First of all, I think as we studied where we should open our first store, we realized that the Metro consumer in India, and I don't mean Metro, the German company, but Metro as in Metropolis, is much better served than the semi-rural consumer in Amritsar. So what happens is that most of the manufacturers, their big markets are in metro towns, and most of their senior management lives there. And they go and their wives go and shop there and so on and so forth. So if products are not available in those markets, there's a big UN cry. If product is not available in a small village in Punjab, nobody even knows about that. So what happens is, I mean, just to give you an example, we sold 4 or 5 truckloads of butter in 1 week 2 months ago in Amritsar. And, you know, I was asking my merchants, you know, why somebody, everybody in Amritsar seemed to be, you know, suddenly eating so much butter. And, yeah, yeah, that's, but it wasn't that. It was just the fact that India had a very poor monsoon this year. And as a result, the milk supply was affected. And butter production was affected. Butter is largely produced in Gujarat by one large manufacturer called Amul. And Amul, I mean, Amritsar is as far as you can get from Amul, you know, on the Indian. So nobody cares about Amritsar, you know. They just so that market never got any butter for a month. And butter is also a perishable commodity, as in you have to keep it in a cold chain. So that makes it even more tougher for people to store, because they can't store it. We are the only ones in the town who had access to that butter in truckloads from Anand. And also had a cold chain to be able to keep it at the right conditions. And as a result, everybody in Amritsar was buying butter from us. All the trade was buying butter from us. So I think that's one big difference between the so-called metro model and our model. The other thing you may have observed is that the metro stores are very large. They are almost 100,000 square feet. We are less than half of what they are. And that's because I think our assortment is very, very focused on trade. So we do not sell stuff for personal consumption. And when you really look at it, you know, in detail and at a you know high level, it doesn't seem like it. But what the trade buys from stores like this and what the consumer buys from stores like this is totally different in a country like India. Coming back to the point about unit consumption, the wholesale trade really buys stuff which then goes into the upcountry markets from Amritsar. That's what they buy. And there, again, because of the rural population and so on, small unit sizes will sell. So if you're selling toothpaste, it'll be a 50-gram toothpaste, not a 200-gram toothpaste. That's what will move. So most of our assortment will be 50-gram toothpaste assortment in packs of 24s and 48s. Whereas I think some of the other stores have assorted themselves 100 grams, 50 grams, everything. And therefore, that sort of, you know, kind of, almost lures customers to want to buy for their personal consumption. Lastly, we have a very, very rigorous program for enlisting members and checking them before they get into our store to shop. And we have $11, which is about 500 rupees minimum ticket value. So nobody is casually just walking into a store to buy, you know, a Coke or a Pepsi or something like that. So the minimum ticket value has to be 500 rupees. Otherwise, we don't run you through the cash register. So we are taking some of those steps to ensure that we are servicing only the genuine bona fide trade.
I did see, although your store had an electronic goods section.
Yes.
With flat screen TVs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I was trying to figure out, is this something that other businesses would buy in bulk? That seems to be aimed at individual customers.
Yeah, we sold a lot of those, and we still sell them a lot of those because the hotels are our big customers for those. So there are a lot of hotels who are setting up, you know, hotel chains. So if there's a 20-room hotel coming up in Amritsar, they want to buy 20 small flat-screen TVs, and it's meant for those. So similarly, refrigerators or music system, you know, some of those, you know, appliances which may look like, this doesn't look like a trade SKU, But the truth is, you know, this goes to the what we call the HoReCa segment, which is hotels, restaurants, and caterers. And they buy a lot of that stuff. Thank you. Yes, please. Yeah, as I said earlier, I think my own perception is there is more to be done in this area of convincing people that's the right thing to do. I think a lot of people think that retailing is only about retailing. I think retailing is that tip of the iceberg, which nobody sees as the big supply chain which goes beneath it. And I think once we are able to get our story of the supply chain right and how it will help the farmer, how it will help the country, how it will help consumption, how it will help the customer, I do believe the government will make a move forward, because this is not about protecting the small mom-and-pop stores. This is about the whole country. This is about the farmers. This is about the suppliers and so on. And even then, I would argue, and I think there are several case studies to show that, in any country where retail is open, in emerging economies, mom-and-pop still 70-80% of the total business. So I think there is place for both, because what a mom-and-pop store can do in the neighborhood with the home delivery and with the personalized service and with some of those things which modern retail can never do, I think there will always be the space for both of them. So, but we need to just get our message across more and understood, and some of the latent fears of people to be able to come out and feel comfortable with. So. I think it's both. I mean, as I said, our experience has been that people have not worried so much about home deliveries and come to our stores wherever we've opened our stores, our Bharti stores, and that's data which is there for us to see. I do believe, as I said earlier, I think there'll be place for both, because if, as you know, in India, if you had an uninvited or an unexpected guest at home and you wanted to serve them something and you didn't have it, you are not going to go shopping at that point in time. But you still have the facility of calling up your grocer and saying, can you just send me some Coke and Pepsi and this and that, because I just have some people who landed up at my house. And that will always stay. And that's why I do believe that that is something modern retail will never be able to do. Sorry. I think that probably may have been a case 2-3 years ago in terms of thinking. What has happened in the last 3 years is several domestic companies have entered into retailing. And many of them have realized that, you know, it seems simple, it looks like running a shop, but it isn't. It takes lots of investment, it takes lots of technology, it takes a lot of management processes and systems. And almost all these companies want to actually have a foreign investor or a foreign collaborator and so on and so forth. So my own perception at this time is that most domestic retailing business would be very happy if this law was to be changed, because they need the help in terms of technology, they need the help in terms of financial support, and retailing is a business which takes 10-15 years to break even. It's not a business which, you know, overnight you set up a few stores and you start making money. So it's a long-term investment game too. So it requires foreign capital. Yes. Okay, small answers. I think we chose Amritsar because it's prototypical of the kind of town we wanted to open our store in. It's not a small town. It's a medium-sized town with 1.6 million people. It seems like a small town in India, but it's a fairly large town. It is it's a big feeder market to northern parts of India near the border and so on and so forth. That's ideal for cash and carry and so on. It's in a state which is very progressive in its outlook. Punjab is a very progressive state. A lot of people from Punjab live overseas, and they have a good idea of what modern retail and supply chains look like. It has a very evolved farming community. You know, Punjab is the top agrarian state in India. And it is politically very stable. I mean, there are there's a Congress government and there's an Akali government. Between the two, they get elected. So you don't get too much instability in the state. So when you put all that together, it just seemed like the right place to start with, you know. And then, of course, lastly, I forgot to mention, it's got the Golden Temple. So, you know, it's a wholly nice place to start your business with. So that's why we opened in Amritsar. Why do people come and shop at our stores? Yes, air conditioning could be one of the reasons, and that's why I said people don't want to be at their home when they have a better, you know, temperature control at the store where they shop. So that's why I think that could be one of the areas or issues. Having said that, I think the Indian consumer is still very, very price sensitive. So they will still demand the lowest price. So the challenge for the retailer is, can you provide air conditioning and yet be the lowest cost price retailer? And, you know, people need to figure out that answer. I'm sorry, I forgot the question. Yeah, I think vegetables we sell even in the U.S. So, yeah. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yes, my name is Lloyd Walker from American University. After having moved to Portland, Oregon. Portland, Oregon is the home of two institutions of note. One is Nike. And Nike has been charged, particularly by organized labor here in the United States, for producing shoes and athletic apparel with substandard conditions. I've also heard that Walmart has been similarly charged. And so my question to you is, how do you respond to these, particularly from organized labor here in the United States? Now, the other side of the coin is there is another institution in Portland called the Mercy Corps. And the Mercy Corps was criticized fairly recently for collaborating with Walmart, particularly in the production of coffee in Guatemala. Apparently, the Mercy Corps was able to convince Walmart to agree to a variety of conditions which favored the coffee growers in Guatemala, much to the satisfaction of Mercy Corps. And that seems to me the opposite side of the I was just wondering whether you would have any response to those kinds of criticisms.
I think I'm not best qualified to answer the questions on the U.S. side of the business, and I really don't know the details of the coffee issue. But on the labor side, all I can say is that I think one of the things today in a country like India is that there is no control over how labor is paid, what they are paid, how it's controlled, how goods and services are manufactured, etc., because most of this is very informal. And invariably, if you took a sample survey, you'd probably find that 70-80% of those practices are below minimum wages, what we would call in India. I think one of the advantages of modernizing and upgrading and making this whole supply chain and retailing more transparent is that that'll all become more organized and formal, and would fall and then fall into the compliance of the law initiative. So I think we go to a lot of we go through a lot of pain in terms of ensuring that we are auditing all our suppliers well, ensuring that they are following all those ethical practices, food safety standards are being followed. We have third-party auditors who ensure that for produce, etc., which we do sell at our stores. So I think whatever best we can do for our supply chain, we are doing, and I do believe that in all this area, formalizing the supply chain and making it more efficient and modern is going to help in more compliance, because there's very little right now in the informal sector. I think all I can say is that, first of all, Walmart's association with China in retailing is over a decade old. So, I think our history is much, much longer in China than it is in India. And however, I was not there, but when I talked to the people who were there, I mean, they would say that the initial issues were exactly the same as we are facing in India. So it hasn't been any different. Having said that, and having lived in China, my own view is that the only thing which is common to India and China is 1 billion-plus people. And honestly, I mean, I think it's a completely different country with completely different issues compared to India. And whereas there are some parallels and there are some learnings which can be utilized, and we do those, but, I mean, the political system, the social fabric, the consumer, everything is so different in China compared to India, and the infrastructure, that I think both those countries have to have their own unique solutions. So we've had a much longer history as a company in China than we have in India, and therefore currently our business is doing very well and growing very well in China and so on. India is at a very initial stage of its development in the retailing area, and but I mean I really don't know whether one can draw parallels between the two. Yes, ma'am.
At one time, there were prohibitions or severe restrictions on firing labor and letting labor off. Do those still persist, or how has Walmart dealt with that, if they do?
Yes, I mean there are labor is a regulated market in India. It's not easy to fire people. Hiring there is no restriction on. So far we are in a hiring mode. So, and I don't see ourselves worrying about firing people. So, honestly, that's not a problem which we currently is on our radar screen. Sorry, sir, you had it.
I wish that we had more presentations like this because I think worldwide they're suffering from the macroeconomics. Because you show actually what is happening rather than, you know, this would be nice if it could happen. I was fascinated with your model. You seem to suggest that you're going to give higher prices to the farmers. You also are suggesting that the low prices in the shop, the individual consumer will continue to, you know, influence you. What kind of margins are you going to get to pay for this greater capital investment and more efficient distribution in the supply chain? And roughly, who are you going to squeeze out to be able to get that in your pocket? Because without that, it's not going to work. Now, you suggested there may be 4 or 5 wholesale intermediaries, each of them taking 1-2% as their wholesale margin, which has been traditional in India for decades. Now, my question is this, what is your target margin internal to be able to A, not lose money, and to make a reasonable return on your capital?
Sure. I think, you know, return on capital, obviously, you know, any good company would like to have upwards of 12-13% return on capital, because that's the cost of capital globally, irrespective of whichever business you are in. As far as retail margins are concerned, because we're not doing retailing, we really don't know. We are just doing wholesaling right now, and you're absolutely right, the wholesaling margins are very, very small in India. They are, you know, in the range of 2-4%, that's what it is. And it is not adequate to pay for the capital invested. And that's why there is this strong case for FDI in retailing. Because if, you know, serious investment has to be made, which has to be, then something has to pay for it, and that has to be from the retail margin or the whole margin in the supply chain. Having said that, I think, you know, the real point I want to make is that I think it is not going to come at the expense of anybody. It is going to come at the expense of removing the inefficiency in the system. And that inefficiency lies in huge amount of working capital tied up in the supply chain today, at various points with various intermediaries, which will all free up and be available for you know, other kinds of development. It'll lie in you know, reducing the wastage in perishables anywhere from 10% to 30%, in food grains maybe 5-7%, in many other items you know, of various percentages, and you can pick any number. And finally, I genuinely believe in improving consumption. Because what it will do is that when you make things available to people, I mean, what happened to the people in Amritsar who didn't get butter? They just didn't eat butter. That was it. You know, if they had butter, they would have consumed more butter. And that's good for everybody because they wanted butter. They would have consumed butter, meant more butter production, meant more jobs, meant everything, everybody gains. So I think what this whole model is going to do is to help improve consumption. And that, I think, is the real juice of all this. Because the moment you have availability, people will consume, you know, because that's what they want to do and they go shopping. So I really don't think that it's a question of squeezing out anybody. I think if we just remove waste, if we improve working capital, and if we improve availability, which in turn will drive more consumption, that will be more than enough to pay for any investment which is made into this.
So basically what you're suggesting is your margins will remain the same, but your turnover will increase, therefore your profits will be higher.
Absolutely. I mean, the whole model works on high velocity. High velocity, yeah. Yes.
Basically with IT. I don't know if you're doing similar, or what's your strategy in that?
Yeah, I think eChopal is a very interesting initiative, and you know, it's been fairly successful in terms of bringing transparency to what I would say food and food grain pricing to farmers. My only comment on that is that what it does through IT technologies, and this is a classical case where, you know, because of IT and technology, we are ahead of ourselves, literally, because we have information, but we don't know what to do with information. So, and you know, that is a classical trap you can fall into. So a farmer who really is only concerned about, you know, growing the crop, harvesting the crop, and selling the crop, now knows, which he didn't know in the past, what exactly is the price of that crop in every market, you know, in India. What he doesn't know is, how can he sell it to those people? And there's no buyers in his neighborhood who's going to buy it at that price. So that has been, I think, one of the key issues, which I think the modern supply chain and retailing can solve. Because it's one thing having the information, it's another thing having a real mechanism to trade. So I think what some of these initiatives have done, it has provided information, which is great. But there is real crop to be sold. And where is the buyer? So and there are no buyers at that point to buy at that that price, number one. And the government laws will not allow, because of the various restrictions and movement of food grains, etc., for that farmer to be able to sell, even if there was a theoretical buyer sitting 1,000 miles away. And that is, I think, the big issue. So I think it's a good initiative. I think it's a good starting point, but it is not practical from the point of view of actually doing trade.
I think we have time for one more question, and then we have to let our distinguished visitor go.
Thank you. Yes.
Someone else have another question? Go ahead.
Bob Morrissey, Amore Associates. I wonder if you could comment a little bit more on sourcing of produce from the farm sector, a little bit what your future plans might be, whether you do long-term contracts with farmers, maybe establish your own farms, work with small landholders. Do you have a plan for that?
I think it's an evolving plan. I don't think we have a really solidified roadmap yet. I think contract farming, and I mean, owning our own farms is highly unlikely. I don't even know whether legally it's possible, so it's too complicated to even think about. I think contract farming is a possibility in the long term or medium to long term. I think in the short term, the first thing is, you know, again, keeps coming back to the same point. We need to understand our customers, and we do understand what they want, when they want it, and what price they want it. We need to take that information, use it effectively, and boil it down to simple things for the farmer, which we can do through our direct engagement with the farmer, and say, okay, I need so many kilos of tomatoes every day in the winter months, and so many kilos of tomatoes every day in the summer months. And if you can do that to me, that's great. And I think just a simple thing like that would solve a lot of problems for the farmers, for us, etc. So I think that is one area where we are working or trying to work to get some. The other area is in terms of reducing this whole waste. So putting some processing centers in strategic locations, so we can bring, rather than, you know, take 50 kilos from each farmer and cart it all the way to our stores, you know, kind of bring it somewhere and disaggregate and aggregate it again, and then have what I would say, you know, store-ready packaging, so that you can move it in plastic trays or whatever it is, so that, you know, things don't get spoiled, etc., straight into the store. So on that side of the chain, I think we are working. And lastly, I think we are also working with the farming communities as we grow our relationship with them, just from the point of view of their own social infrastructure. Whether it's education, whether it's sanitation, you know, some of the things which goes around in these villages, just so that their own life itself starts to look better than what it is today. And that is more a CSR activity right now, but I think it is going to have a deep impact in terms of A, the relationship we develop with the farmer, and B, I think in the consistency of supply, which we can then be assured of if we earn the trust.
What's the short-term feedback you're getting from the farmers today
Yes, very, very positive. Yeah, extremely. Thank you. Thanks.
Well, I would like to thank our speaker. Before you all depart, it seems to me that he's given us, in addition, some thoughts on the interconnectedness of development and economic change in India. And to me, two examples of this, which also show how his career has dovetailed with two of the kind of light bulb moments for me when I realized how fast things were changing in India. The first of these moments came in about 1992, when I was visiting Delhi and went for lunch at the home of a man who had worked in my office when I was posted there, which was in a nice neighborhood across the Jamna, kind of a lower middle class neighborhood, more scooters than cars, a lot of small kiranas. And we came around the corner into a big square, and there, looking down on us, was a large billboard advertising automatic washing machines. I don't know if they were Whirlpool. But that was my first light bulb moment. If a neighborhood like this thinks it can sell automatic washing machines, something has changed. The second flies in directly with something that Mr. Jain talked about. The young woman who worked in my office up until last May as my research associate came back from a visit to her family in Mumbai and said, "You won't believe what happened when I was at home." "What happened, Vibhuti?" Well, she had come into the living room and found her mother on the phone. And her mother was talking about vegetables, okra, tomatoes, potatoes. "Mom, who were you talking to?" "Oh, I was talking to my vegetable vendor, a pushcart guy. I was telling him what he needed to make sure and get today so that I could buy it." So the cell phone, electricity, all these other things are part of the process that he was talking about. Thank you all for being with us today.